Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is Burt Weisbord, and I'm here to talk with my brother Rick about my novel Inside Passage. We'll be discussing the book, then talking about the variations in moral development in the novel. Rick does research on and writes about moral development. I've produced feature films, including Ghost Story, starring Fred Astaire, and Raggedy Man, starring Sissy Spacek. My first novel, Inside Passage, was published in January of this year. Rick is a child and family psychologist on the faculty of Harvard School of Education and the Kennedy School of Government. His most recent book, The Parents We Mean to Be, is a fascinating look at how well-intentioned adults undermine children's moral and emotional development. It was named one of the top books of 2009 by The New Yorker. Hello, Rick.
Hello, Bert. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you for joining me. Let's just jump right in. Could you talk for a minute about what you thought of my novel, Inside Passage, particularly in the context of your work?
Yeah, and I will talk outside of our relationship as your brother. I really think, you know, there are moments where I can see the novel quite objectively, and I just think it's a superb novel, superbly psychological and psychologically nuanced as well as thrilling. It's just a rip-roaring ride, so I really do want to recommend the novel. And it's also just a very interesting novel about ethical issues and moral development, you know, a range of characters who bring to the novel, who bring to their lives different moral capacities, but also take different moral paths. And it's a very interesting novel about something else I'm very interested in, which is moral mentoring. I think it's got a couple of people who actually are terrible as moral mentors and a couple of people who really have some superb skills as moral mentors. So very interesting in that way as well.
Well, let's talk about that. And let me also highly recommend Rick's book, The Parents We Mean to Be, which is really an exceptional book about parenting and moral development in children. So he's uniquely qualified to talk about these issues. Let's look first at Nick Season, who is the antagonist and really a psychopath, and at the same time has deep empathic abilities. What would you say about Nick, Rick?
I think psychopath is the right word. I mean, there are people who are really lacking in a moral compass of any kind, and Nick is one. And you know, Nick is just sadistic in a lot of different ways. But you know, the word empathy is an interesting word because it's a word we use a lot now. There's a lot of interest in building empathy in kids and building empathy in adults. But I think we're using it in somewhat of a confusing way because, you know, we use empathy to mean being able to take someone else's perspective or to step in someone else's shoes. But people who torture other people or salespeople or con men or somebody like Nick Season is remarkably adept at taking someone else's perspective. I mean, Nick's sort of a great example because he is so skilled at manipulating people that, you know, his perspective-taking skills, in one sense, his empathy is much greater than many of the other characters in the novel, many people in life. He can also experience what other people feel to some degree. I mean, that's part of what makes him so effective, that he kind of gets what other people feel. The issue is he doesn't care what other people feel or other people's feelings trigger in him, you know, anxiety in other people or anger in other or sadness in other people or uncertainty in other people don't trigger in him positive feelings. They trigger in him negative feelings. They make him angrier and more sadistic. So, you know, this is why when we talk about empathy, we got to talk about a skill, you know, the skill of taking somebody else's perspective. We got to talk about the value, the getting people to value other people and to know and appreciate who they are. And we got to talk about what gets in the way of empathizing. And with somebody like Nick, there's certainly an ugly, you know, really traumatized, ugly history that's really getting in the way with him empathizing with other people. And instead, feelings of sadness and grief make him furious.
You know, you make a really interesting point, because Nick, who in the novel is charismatic and very well liked and appears to be very understanding and sensitive to other people as well as empathic, is running for state attorney general and is a shoo-in if it weren't for the events in the book. And what his biggest, you know, what has brought him to where he is his ability to really see what other people want and give them the illusion that they're getting it, or actually get it for them, whereas at the same time he doesn't care at all about their well-being. I mean, it's all in the service of advancing his own interests.
Yeah, he's a totally self-promoting, self-serving guy. And, you know, and as you say, he's got terrific social and emotional intelligence. And, you know, there are a lot of people in the business world. I'm not cracking on people in the business world, but there are a lot of ethical people in the business world, too. But there are a lot of people in the business world who have great social and emotional intelligence, but they don't really have a strong ethical compass. They don't really care about what other people feel. And Nick is obviously, you know, far more extreme and in a different breed in a way. But I think you described him very well. And he's a fascinating character in that way.
Well, let's go a little deeper, too, because not only does he have no ethical or moral compass, but Nick is, as a young person, was abused and he has decided, and he has these paralyzing anxiety attacks as a young man, and he decided that the way to master his anxiety was to simply remove the source, even if that meant killing someone. And that's a very crude and childish idea, but he's taken it to an extreme, and so that nothing else matters except the absence of anxiety and self-promotion.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that's one thing that's interesting about the novel is that you have more than one character who have been traumatized. So, you know, Nick's been traumatized as a child, but my memory is that Corey's been traumatized in jail, too. I mean, Corey has a... Go ahead, sorry.
No, I'm glad you're turning to Corey. We should talk about her because, yes, of course. I mean, she was framed and her... And it's Nick who framed her, and Nick who told her that he would kill her child. Is what he killed her lover, and he said he would kill her child if she didn't go to jail and stay out of his life.
Yeah, and my memory was that she'd already been in jail once, right? Is that correct?
She was busted before, but she didn't do
two. She was busted before. But anyway, there, you know, there are a lot of different ways people can respond to trauma, and, you know, usually... If people are traumatized and they're able to make it comprehensible and manageable and they have people who really listen to them and really care about them around them, they're able to respond to trauma in ways that sort of retain their basic humanity. And, you know, so it gets you thinking about what happened to Nick and what environment did he grow up in, and he was clearly abused, and, you know, it also seems like there were not people around who could make sense of this for him, and so he makes sense of it in a way, as you said, that a young child makes sense of these kind of things, very primitively, and by developing a coping strategy that's very primitive and very early childlike, which is to, just as you put it very well, just to remove the source of who's ever causing him any anxiety gets eliminated, so...
And
right.
Corey finds herself in that unfortunate position, which is here he is running for state attorney general and in a relationship with a woman who is, as it happens, the other protagonist, Abe's mother, and she's a mover and shaker in Democratic national politics, and we ought to talk about her too, but let's stay on Corey for a minute. But Corey knows his dirty secret. And he can't bear that.
Yeah, so here's the other thing that I was going to say about Nick, which I think is very connected to what you're saying. You know, there's a lot of evidence now, you know, in the work that, in the field I'm in, the work that I do, that shame is at the root of violence. There, a guy named James Gilligan did a book about shame and violence where he interviewed people in prison, some of whom were on death row, and almost all of whom had committed horrific crimes.
I've read this book at your suggestion for teaser.
Yeah, and you know, and one of the things that he finds out is almost all the guys on death row, almost all the people on death row, had been humiliated severely as children. I mean, it was abuse, but it was also humiliation. And for them, being disrespected was worse than death. And so they would eliminate anyone who in any way sparked feelings of shame in them. And, you know, a lot of gang violence is about disrespect. In Nick's case, that Corey, a woman, has the audacity to take him on is humiliation for him and, you know, triggers this huge well of shame and rage. So I think that that she knows his dirty secret, even the words you use, his dirty secret. You know, it's an image of shame, right? It's an image of her knowing something bad about him, something defective about him, defective in the self. And that's really what shame is.
That's really interesting, Rick. And it's, you know, I wasn't sort of tuned into it at the time, but I remember reading Gilligan's book, and I remember his idea of living dead. And Nick is
yes.
like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Nick is living dead, right? I mean, he's, yeah.
And people like that don't feel things, and it's so remarkable. And you can see it in his sexual relationship with Jesse, where he, when she wants to please him, it makes him feel shame.
Yeah. It's a very interesting scene. He can't bear it, right? He just can't
right.
bear that. So. Yeah.
Let's talk a little more about Abe Stein, and let me just set this up. Abe is the psychiatrist that Corey's coming out of prison where she was framed by Nick, and all she wants is to get her son back, who's in foster care. And she, in order to do this, there's an adjudication process, and she has to have a psychiatric evaluation. And she ends up going to Dr. Abe Stein for this evaluation. At first, he doesn't believe her. But later on, after he realizes he was wrong and she has to run away from Nick, he goes and finds her, and they fall in love. And I think Abe is a really interesting character because he has such a superb moral compass, even when he's wrong, especially when he's wrong.
Yeah.
And let's talk about that a little.
So, you know, there are a lot of things I love about Abe. He is a wonderful character, and, you know, interesting to me, too, because, I don't know, one wouldn't say that Abe has been quite traumatized, but he does grow up with a very status-conscious mother who doesn't really understand him at all, I mean, for whom he's sort of alien and foreign, and has somehow managed to overcome that. But, you know, yeah, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
No, I think, you know, one of the things that I really like about Abe is that I think, you know, we have this idea sometimes that our moral mentors or moral models are imperfect. And Abe is a very different kind of person. He is, as you said, you know, he's a person who has some imperfections and he makes mistakes and he thinks about it deeply. I mean, he really puzzles over those mistakes and figures out how to correct them. And, you know, I think that's what great mentoring is about. I think that's what great psychiatry is about. It's not being arrogant in the way that some psychiatrists can be quite arrogant. It's it is that capacity for self-reflection and recognizing your frailties and recognizing your mistakes. He's also, you know, somebody who's, my recollection or my take about him is that he's somebody who has tremendous wisdom, but he's not. But he really deliberates, and he really puzzles, and he thinks and he talks to people. And I think around most ethical issues, you know, where we make the mistake is when we act very reflexively. And you know, you see this on sports fields when parents act like idiots or when coaches make quick decisions. But the more we're able to reflect and to take multiple perspectives, to talk to people, to really puzzle, far more likely to arrive at a decision that is encompasses more perspectives is more empathic and wiser.
No, I think that you've really characterized Abe very well. I mean, Abe is a person who, you know, unlike Nick, who figured things out as a sort of alienated, abused, lonesome child.
Yeah.
Abe has sorted things out in a very complicated, complex, adult way. And figured out what his real needs are. And is therefore able to experience things at a deeper level than Nick, certainly. And is able to see that Corey is the right person for him, as unlikely as that is.
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting point. I think he does see that. And, you know, he also just is really able to organize himself around other people and to really organize himself around her in a way that... You know, we may talk about this later, but one of the things, as you know, I'm doing research on is romantic relationships, and I think about Abe sometimes because, you know, one of the things that we're coming up in this research in romantic relationships is how we're returning to an age more and more where of greater misogyny and women subordinating themselves more in their romantic relationships, and you know, Abe's a striking person in many ways because he really is able to organize himself around other people, including the women in his life. And that's really a lot about what learning how to love somebody is, right? It's, you know, learning how to organize yourself around somebody else.
Well, let's talk more about this because this is an important theme in the book and you're working on it currently. And, you know, it's, you know, and we should talk also about Billy and Morgan, who is,
yeah.
Billy is Corey's son and Morgan and his girlfriend, and that's a story of first love. And, you know, Billy is a good example of a lot of what we've been talking about because he's been in foster care. He has can't tell. He plays on a select soccer team, so he's gotten to know these private school kids. And Morgan, his girlfriend, goes to a fancy private school, and he can't tell her about his mom, who's in jail. He can't tell her that he's in foster care. He can't tell her he's been in juvenile detention. And yet they manage to have a really lovely relationship. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, you know, there are a few things about the relationship that I am really struck with and that are connected to the research that I do, the research that's underway. You know, one is, I think we have this idea that, you know, the simple story we tell is that boys are predators and girls are prey, and we got to tell boys not to be predators, and I think we absolutely do, and we got to tell girls how to protect themselves. But I think about the relationship between Billy and Morgan because, you know, what the research is showing, my research, but also other people's research who've been doing this for a lot longer than I have, is that a lot of boys are very vulnerable in relationships, and they're very romantic. And, you know, Billy, in many ways, is a very romantic character.
Yes, he is.
You know, really falls in love with Morgan and you know, is deciding how vulnerable to be with her. I mean, how much to reveal about himself to her. And I'm saying this because I think we have to tell boys that they have to not be predators or too aggressive, but we also need to tell boys how to protect themselves. And boys are very vulnerable in relationships too. And we got to tell girls how to protect themselves, but we also got to tell girls how not to hurt other people. And, you know, I'm just arguing for not too simple messages and a little bit more complex messages for both boys and girls in situations like this. And I know one of the things that, you know, I was moved by about their relationship is that Billy makes the choice to take a chance to really be vulnerable with her in the relationship. And, you know, it's a very hard thing to do. You know, we live in an age where kids can be subject to ostracism and bullying quite quickly, and that could have happened in this case. And you kind of think, you know, or I kind of thought, you know, maybe because Corey is Billy's mother, he has a little more trust or a little more faith and is able to take this chance. And, you know, his faith is rewarded. Morgan is really mature, very mature in a lot of ways, and is able to hear the truth and, you know, seems to love him more, not less, because he makes himself vulnerable.
Well, you described this very well. You know, there is a sort of parallel that between Billy and Morgan and Abe and Corey, because in a way, it's also a story of first love for Abe.
Yes.
And
I forgot how old Abe is, but he's
Abe
not
is 38
young, right?
In the book.
Yeah, he's
38. And although Corey's been in a relationship before, it was not the love of her life. But that I think the well of strength out of which, you know, both of those relationships draw is Corey. I mean, there's something about her that she has. I mean, the time she spends with Billy in the Inside Passage when he's young, and the closeness that they have, I think, gives him the strength to take the risks that he takes with Morgan. And there's something about Corey that causes Abe to make himself vulnerable and discover the love that he's never experienced before.
Yeah. And, you know, Corey's a very compelling, I mean, you know, I don't know how you would identify that something. That something in Corey, I mean, she's a very compelling character. You know, she's just a very courageous character, and she's so the opposite of his mom.
Let's talk about her for a second.
Yeah. About the mom?
Yeah. Well, how that she's the opposite of the mom.
Well, no, I mean, you know, I think of the mom as being, you know, she's one of these people, very status conscious. She's one of these people who is very political, can't really figure out Abe or locate him within her orbit, within her universe. Is always kind of, you know, working people. I mean, not an evil person the way Nick is, but a narcissistic person who values certain things like money and accomplishment and status and, you know, is really...
And appearances.
So important. And what?
And appearances.
And appearances, I mean, yeah.
It's very much how she is being manipulated by Nick. I mean, she falls for this guy who is rotten at the core, and she doesn't even know it.
And she doesn't get that's a great point. That's right. So she doesn't get it about somebody that's as evil as Nick. Yeah.
And it's part of where the idea for the novel started, which is to take two relationships, one of which seems perfect, which is Jesse and Nick. You know, they walk into a room and they're both charismatic and beautiful looking and accomplished, and yet the relationship is rotten at the core. And then you have Abe and Corey, who are the most unlikely couple. I mean, she's like very able on the water. She was a fisherwoman in Alaska. And, you know, he's kind of clumsy and not very well dressed and, you know, everything his mother would not want him to be. But they find something invaluable within their connection. And it brings them both to life.
Yeah, and I think that all makes a lot of sense to me, and I think when I said that Corey and Jesse were opposites, I was talking about a version of that, which is, you know, Corey is just, I mean, there's just a deep authenticity about her, right? Like the appearances, the status stuff, she could, you know, my sense about it, she could care less about that stuff.
Exactly.
And she's about, like, knowing and being known, you know, like having real relationships with people. And it's just an entirely different way of being in a relationship with somebody else. And I just sort of imagine that for Abe to finally find somebody who is really interested in him and gets to know him and really affirm who he is. Yeah, for who he is, yeah. Is, you know, that's profound for somebody like Abe.
And totally unexpected in this woman who he has judged so unfairly.
Yeah,
I mean, he assumes she's guilty, you know, because most of the people who come to him for, you know, post-prison evaluation say they're innocent, and in fact, they are not.
So this is a case, you know, it's sort of interesting. I mean, I'm just sort of putting this together, and maybe it doesn't belong together, but... You know, Abe is very, you know, has probably had tons of people manipulate him, right? I mean, not only his mother, but also all these people who are in post-release, post-prison release, who are coming to him, who are trying to manipulate him in one way or another.
Who are after something from him that, you know.
Or they're after something from him. And, you know, in a way, his mother's after something from him, too, right, that he doesn't want to give.
Which has to do with meeting her needs, not his needs.
But meeting her needs, and in the same way these released prisoners are about having to, something that meets their needs. And, you know, so it's sort of interesting to me that Abe may develop really great skills at working with people who are trying to manipulate him in ways that meet their needs, and in seeing through people who are doing that, but also seeing people who, you know, he ends up really getting who Corey is and how she's different too.
Yeah, and it's what you said earlier. It's because he thinks about his mistake.
Yeah.
He misjudges her, and then he learns that she's fled and that she's in danger, and he thinks about this, and he goes after her. He admits he made a mistake, and he convinces her to let him help her because, you know, he says he doesn't often, you know, this is what he's supposed to be good at, and when he makes a mistake, he doesn't often get a second chance.
Yeah. Yeah, so wonderful quality.
Maybe we should talk for just a minute before wrapping up about Teaser, which is the book that comes after Corey Logan and is about private school kids and street kids. And again, I think raises a lot of the issues that you study and write about.
Yeah, well, I'm a huge fan of Teaser, and I'm a huge fan of it for a few different reasons. One is, I mean, I just want to say two things about the hookup culture. One is that it is, in fact, quite exaggerated, just in the sense that the number of kids who are involved in hooking up is not nearly as great as people think it is. And most people are, you know, in some ways much more like Billy and Morgan in Inside Passage. They're fumbling through how to have a relationship with somebody else. But there is this group of kids, and it's not an insignificant group of kids, who are involved in this hookup culture, are getting involved sexually in things that are, like, beyond their capacity to manage. And Teaser really is, my point of view, very insightful, very perceptive about these kids, and also insightful and perceptive about how vulnerable they are, how people can prey on them. I mean, it's very much about somebody preying on one of these kids, how sexually mature they are in many ways and how immature they are in other ways, and also about how adults not really getting them, you know, and being able to connect with them in any significant way, and how dangerous that is when the adults become very moralistic about it and don't really seek to understand them or listen to them.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's it. I'm done. That's all.
So that's the common theme. I mean, that's the difference between, I mean, it's what you put so well about Abe and Corey and the authenticity of their relationship. And that's the theme in Teaser. Those families that are able to develop authentic relationships with their children, in which they recognize their kids' real needs as opposed to what the school is telling them about what will get them in the college or status symbols or the things that they think the kids should be. And they're able to see them for who they really are and work constructively with their strengths and weaknesses, have different kinds of families, and those families that buy into, in this case, a very a school that's very sort of politically correct and very emphatic about getting the kids into the very best schools possible, and that's being the most important thing, and missing what the kids' real experience is.
Yeah. And I think your comment about political correctness raises an important point, which is, you know, the parents that we're talking about who don't get their kids, they, you know, from my perspective, they come in all political stripes. I mean, you know, there are conservative parents who don't get their kids. There are a lot of liberal parents who really pride themselves on listening to their kids, but they don't really get their kids either.
Right.
And they don't get their kids because they are caught up in ideologies about children, or caught up in status concerns, or caught up in different kinds of apparent appearances than other parents are. You know, they want their kid to be the happiest, or they want their kid to be the most sensitive, or, you know, whatever it is. But they're not really knowing who their kids are and how their kids are different from them. And, you know, in both cases, kids can feel invisible. In both cases, kids can go underground. In both cases, kids can learn to closet feelings that they think their parents won't accept, or feel like they're defective when they have those feelings. So lots of damage. And sometimes that damage gets acted out sexually. And that's, you know, one of the things Teaser's about and really describes very well.
You know, Rick, I am enjoying this so much I could go on for hours, but I think we should wind down. And I'd like to, for you to be able to tell people how to buy your book, if you can take a minute.
Well, that's very nice. the book is The Parents We Mean to Be. That's my most recent book. And it's you can get it on Amazon. It's very easy to get on Amazon. And I also have a website at richardweisbord.com that just explores boils down some of the themes of the book.
Inside Passage is available at Amazon or Barnes & Noble as well. You can go to my website, www.burtweisbord.com, www.burtweisbord.com. Rick's last name is spelled the same way. And that will tell you more about the books that are coming, Teaser and then Minos. And again, Rick, it was a pleasure talking to you, and I hope we can do this again.
Yeah, me too. Thanks, Bert. We'll talk soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
The depot with the General Workers Union, and yet they'll never change a thing. Well, they won't fight, and they're not working. I left you on the debris. Now we both know you got the money.